Hello and welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Dave.
And I'm Annie. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, TV show or book we were a fan of before we were married and that the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
This month, Dave's choice was the original series of The Twilight Zone, which aired from 1959 to 1964 and was a kind of supernatural speculative show with heavy moral messages. Why did you pick it?
So I'm intrigued by this, having gone through a lot of the episodes recently to decide which ones to watch and then picked three really good ones and then watched them, that although it reflects my main reason for choosing the show, which is it's really good, I am surprised as to how few notes I've taken.
So you do seem to have a lot fewer pages than normal.
So maybe it won't be the 90 minutes of Man on Fire. We shall...
I can but hope.
Listeners, to let you into a little secret, I do really like listening to our shows after Annie's edited them and put them up, and I re-listened to Man on Fire yesterday, and it was really good, but I think this one's going to be somewhat shorter.
Although, you did come out of the kitchen whilst you were cooking the dinner to specifically apologise to me for interrupting me a lot and sighing whenever I tried to make a point.
There was quite a lot of sighing whenever you tried to make a point, so I'm very sorry about that. Perhaps
we could think about... a different approach for today. Anyway.
So why did I like it? I liked it because...
Well, no, why did you pick it?
Why did I pick it? Because I liked it. And why did I like it? Because, as you say, it has a... It frequently has a sort of fantasy or science fiction veneer, which obviously appeals to me, but mostly because it's about how people react to each other and things in strange circumstances. And also, it turns out, because of what you said earlier, which is that it has a strong moral message, which I think appeals to me as it goes. What did you think?
Well, I have to say, I was very apprehensive because I have always associated it with being creepy or disturbing or outright scary, and that is not something that I enjoy watching because things do tend to stay in my head and revisit me in the night. Which is not a fun experience. So I was apprehensive, but I think you curated these three episodes very well, because I did enjoy them, although I would be interested to hear how they compare in general to the rest of the oeuvre, because in terms of their message, they were basically all the same.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm.
But I'm sure we will get into that. Did it hold up for you overall? I'm sure it did, because you specifically went through your list of top episodes and picked three that you particularly enjoyed, which you thankfully, and I appreciate it, thought that I would also get something out of. So for
people who don't know anything about the show, the important thing is that this is not an ongoing series with characters that are the same in every episode. They are what used to be called, when I was growing up, a kind of play for today show.
Yeah.
And there used to be a thing literally called that when I was small, and there were quite a lot of...
I think I would call it an anthology show.
Yeah, I can see that. And there were quite a lot of those when I was growing up. There are fewer now. I mean, Black Mirror is a good example.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of series that have... one-off, every single show is a one-off episode.
Yeah, well, Black Mirror must owe a lot to this.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What was the question?
Did it hold up for you overall?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a long time ago, several years ago, I re-watched all of the original Black and White series.
But you had seen some of them before?
Oh yeah, I'd seen the odd episode before.
Okay.
But I got
because I was going to say, I remember you doing that, and it wasn't that long ago, which makes it ineligible.
No, it's several years ago.
Yes, but not pre-2009.
Oh, no, true. Yes, but, you know...
I know, we break the rules all the time.
Okay.
And it is eligible if you'd seen it before and liked it.
Yes. But I watched them all.
Oh, shut up now.
And there's 156 episodes.
Yeah. across 5 years, four seasons is pretty impressive.
So I watched all of them, and then I created my own list of the ones that I thought were particularly good, of which there's about 30, something like that.
Okay.
And out of that, the other day, I thought, I'll watch 5 minutes of the ones that I can't remember what they're about,
okay,
which was about a quarter. And I'll also watch a few minutes of the ones that I think are going to be particularly good, so I can say, oh yes, those are definitely the ones I want to do for the show.
Yeah. And how many episodes did you watch them for?
About half, I think.
Wow, yeah, this does not surprise me. So, okay. Yes. So yeah, good. I'm glad. Shall I do a... I wasn't going to do a specific synopsis for each episode, although I can. I was just going to give a brief...
Yeah.
Overview of the show. Absolutely. As I experienced it. I mean, this may not apply beyond the episodes that you picked.
I mean, go on, and I will leap in if it is more.
So, yeah, the original one, which first aired in 1959, was in black and white. And
well, they were in black and white.
Well, not the remakes in the 80s.
Sorry, the original show. Sorry, I thought you meant the original episode. Sorry, Karen.
No.
Sorry.
And... at least for the series that we watched from, because all of the ones you picked were from the first season of that run, were only 25 minutes long, which surprised me.
Yeah, some of the ones that I've kept in that 30 or 40, you know, my favourite ones are an hour, but these ones are all short.
Yeah, they changed the format, and then they went back to the half hour, which is interesting.
Oh, I didn't spot that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they kind of take a premise... which generally involves something supernatural and explore kind of social commentary or a particular theme to do with that and play out what I would call a vignette.
It is exactly that, yes.
Rather than a full story about that with a voiceover that introduces it. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, in two of the episodes, the voiceover man actually turned up and spoke directly to camera, but wasn't a character in the show.
But only very briefly at the
only
start.
Very briefly, or in the middle as well. And then also comes on to do the He-Man style. And this is what lesson you are supposed to take from this episode.
In the... I can never remember what it's called, but the cartoon series with... about Warner Brothers. I don't know what it's called, but there's a thing at the end of that sometimes where they go, spin the wheel of morality to see what you shall learn today.
Yes, indeed.
I don't remember him turning up in the middle, but he definitely turns up at the start and the end, and we'll get into Rod Sterling.
Oh, was that him?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't look that up. Because he was the creator.
Yes.
Right, getting into facts.
I have about as many facts as I have, you know, notes.
Anything
on,
else?
Notes on the rest of the show. So
I had one in particular.
I have huge number of facts.
I thought this was hilarious, that Rod Sterling, who created the show, was already well known and well thought of as a TV writer.
Yes.
And in an interview, this demonstrates how ahead of its time this show was and the specific attitudes of the time to speculative fiction, shall we say. There was an interview that he did at the time in 1959 where the interviewer said, "You're going to be obviously working so hard on The Twilight Zone that in essence, for the time being and for the foreseeable future, you've given up on writing anything important for television, right?" I mean, really? Yikes.
70 years later, nearly.
No.
Jesus, it is 70 years. It's 70 years old.
65, but yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so old.
You are so old. Well, you wouldn't have watched it originally because you weren't born before 1964.
I am aware. But, wow. 65 years old.
Yeah.
And it's still being watched.
Yeah. And being remade because there were remakes
we'll come to all of them.
Yeah, 1985, 2002, and 2019. So, yeah. The only other fact I have is something specific to one of the episodes. So, do you want to do some general ones first?
I'll do a whole bunch of stuff if that's okay.
Of course.
So, I'm going to probably repeat a lot of stuff we've already said. But 1959 to 1964, so obviously it's very early. 5 seasons, 156 episodes in total, a variety of genres, but often, as you say, with some kind of fantasy or supernatural or science fiction twist. I hadn't realised how much they're all based around what's essentially a moral message, but they really are, and I thought that was really interesting. Yeah. So it's all about Rod Serling. He was the guy who these days would be called a showrunner and created the whole show. Now, he, as you said, he'd been doing a lot of writing for other shows previously, but the reason why he wanted to create his own one was not because he was particularly motivated about, you know, science fiction or fantasy concepts, but because the things they'd been writing for previously had had their plots and things they were allowed to do on air severely curtailed by oversight from the sponsors.
Oh, okay.
So the sponsors, so you used to say, sponsored by Super Oil or, you know, this kind of stuff in the middle of the show. It was all very blatant. And the sponsors would get oversight of the scripts and literally be able to force script changes.
Oh, really?
And so wow. The reason why he wanted to run his own show was so that he could choose the sponsors to pick the ones that would let him do the things he wanted to do.
Okay.
So there's a whole bit in the Wikipedia page about him essentially chasing down sponsors to be able to make the kind of show that he wanted. So that's why he wanted to do his own thing.
Okay, makes sense.
So he was the executive producer and the head writer. There were only really three writers that wrote almost all of the show, which I'll get to in a second. So he either wrote or co-wrote 92 of the 156 episodes.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, I suppose you can forgive him for a bit of repetition then.
Mm-hmm. So the three main writers were Rod Serling, Charles Beaumont, who I'd never really heard of, but wrote a whole bunch of stuff. The only thing of which I'd heard of is The Mask of the Red Death, which is a Hammer film, I think, which was very popular when it came out. I've watched it. It's really good.
Okay.
And Richard Matheson, who, have you heard of him?
I mean, the name sounds familiar, but he's someone with the same surname.
He wrote a lot of stuff that's very popular at the time, but he's mostly known for writing I Am Legend.
The original film or book?
Both.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So which was based, what's it called?
The remake with Will Smith.
Yeah.
I Am Legend.
Oh, is it? I thought it was called something else.
No, I don't think so.
The Charlton Heston version was called something else though, wasn't it?
Maybe.
Well, I can't remember. But anyway,
there is a previous Reviews Revisited episode, which I cannot tell you exactly when it was, which I read the book and watched both movies. Mm. So if you are keen listeners to find out more about I Am Legend, you can go and listen to that.
Right. So I'm going to read out an immense list of famous people that were in the show.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I may be sometime.
Uh-huh.
So Bill Bixby, who was best known for being the Incredible Hulk.
Oh, yes.
Buster Keaton.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
Charles Bronson.
Yeah.
Carol Burnett, Robert Duvall, Peter Falk, Dennis Hopper, Ron Howard, Jack Klugman, Martin Landau, Gene Marsh, Lee Marvin, Burgess Meredith, Bill Mummy, when he was about six, went on to be famous in Babylon 5. But the episode of Twilight Zone that he is in is one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen in my entire life.
Okay, feel free not to share.
Julie Newmar, Barbara Nichols, Leonard Nimoy, Donald Pleasance, Robert Redford, Burt Reynolds, Mickey Rooney, Telly Savalas, William Shatner, Dean Stockwell, and George Takei in the very first thing that he was ever on in American television. They took a big chance in the late 50s. When there was still a lot of anti-Japanese feeling in America.
Oh, yes, I can imagine.
To put a Japanese actor in a show, and it's what gave him his big break before he got Star Trek and got him
into
television.
Well, I'm going to be very previous with discussion of certain things at this point in the episode and say that out of 156 episodes, not including the ones that we watched, it's nice to know that at least one of them had a non-white actor in it.
Yes.
We will come back to that.
We will touch on that. There's a particularly interesting thing.
I have a particularly interesting thing about that too. So yes, okay. Very interesting. Okay.
Still going with facts. Daily Variety at the time ranked it as the best that has ever been accomplished in a half-hour filmed television show.
Wow. When did they say that?
In the early 60s.
Okay. So time changed, attitude changed from the interviewer in 1959 quite rapidly because it was so good.
It won 3 Hugo Awards for Best Dramatic Presentation. In terms of ranks in the greatest show of all time lists by various things, TV Guide ranks it as number 26. The Writers Guild of America ranks it at number 3. Rolling Stone ranks it at number 7. And Variety ranks it at number 14. So...
In 2023, no less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It won the Primetime Emmy for Best Writing in both 1960 and 1962, and the Golden Globe for Best Direction in 1963.
Wow.
And you talked about reboots. So, as you say, there was a series from 1985 to 1989, from 2002 to 2003, from 2019 to 2020.
Which I believe we watched.
We watched, and I was a bit meh about, okay, to be honest.
Because it was Jordan Peele?
Yes.
Yeah, Jordan
Peele.
That's
the guy. I'm glad you could see his name, because I could see his face really clearly. I couldn't remember his name. And there was also a film in 1983, which I really should have looked this up before I get this wrong, but I think is the one that was most remembered because there was an accident on set in which somebody died.
Oh, wow. Okay. Not a good reason to be remembered.
But one of the shows that we've done as part of this episode is one of the... I think there's, again, three or four... vignettes that make up the film, unconnected.
Okay, so it's not a whole movie length story.
No.
Oh, interesting.
And one of the episodes that we watched is redone in the film, and I think the film version is better.
Okay.
But I wanted to stick with the black and white ones for us to review.
Well, that makes sense.
And then finally, just to say that the phrase Twilight Zone has entered the popular vernacular. Even if you go to people and say, oh, you're in the Twilight Zone now, even if they've never heard of the show.
They would most likely go, do-do-do-do.
Exactly that.
Which only happened, I think, on one of the episodes that we watched.
So it's interesting, because I hadn't noticed, until you just said it, that the three episodes that we'd chosen were all in the first series.
Yes.
Which made me very confused that they have three very different sets of opening titles and music.
Yes. I found that confusing, too.
Because I assumed they were from different series, because I hadn't checked.
So I have one other fact which relates to the first episode that I saw, which was called The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. Because as soon as it started, there was an actor on screen. I was like, I know him. I know him from somewhere. He's incredibly familiar to me. And I looked him up, and it turns out that he was in one episode of Garrison's Gorillas. Which we did for the podcast in episode 7, which was released in October 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So again, listeners, if you are interested in finding out about one of my all-time favourite TV shows, Garrison's Gorillas, you can go back and listen to the episode. And he was Colonel Pryor
in that episode.
Early 60s. Oh, yeah, okay. Like 1963 or something like that. I didn't look up the date, but yeah, it was for early 60s.
I have no idea who he was, but he didn't half remind me of Henry Fonda.
See, yeah, when you said Charles Bronson, that's who he kind of reminded me of.
Yeah, that too.
So he was one of the main characters in the first episode that we watched. And I was like, I know him. I had to stop it and look him up because it was annoying me. Yay for IMDb is all I can say.
Yes.
Okay, so where do you want to start? Should we go through... Do you have, like, general things you want to talk about? Or episode specific?
I have some limited general things, not much, and then some random,
because obviously it would be useful
episodes
to give like a brief synopsis of each one as we talk
so I'll talk about some general stuff. I should have realized long ago what you said at the start, and only really occurred to me on this rewatch, that they are essentially excuses for being able to do morality plays. That is what they are mainly about, and then they happen to be in a science fiction concept, partly because it lets you do more interesting and unusual or impossible twists, and partly because I guess it was in the zeitgeist in the sort of 50s, 60s that this was when you were getting, I don't know when Star Trek came out, but you know, the kind of, I don't know, Mission Impossible and, you know, this kind of early series. So they were fitting into the zeitgeist. But there's a lot of focus on either contemporary social issues. So there are, like Star Trek, there are ones about race, and there are, you know, ones, one of the ones we do is about beauty standards, and there's all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
But they tend to focus on some similar themes across multiple episodes. You said that these are essentially about the same thing.
Pretty much, yeah. What, I mean, you could argue.
What? So what was that What was that thing?
About how easily we react against people who are different to us,
mm-hmm.
and punish them for that because we're frightened or resentful in some way, and that this is bad.
So there's a number of episodes that attack conformity.
Mm, yes.
Specifically, in the episode we'll talk about in a minute, there's like a bit where there's like telescreens with, you know, the dictator going, we should all be the same and everybody should, you know, do the same thing, and anybody's conformity is terrible. And there's quite a few other episodes where that is more or less a thing. There's a very good episode that I watched but didn't choose with Buster Meredith in which he is the last librarian because the state has destroyed all the other libraries. And
he's,
you know, having to fight against that. I've got a note in my thing that says it's about communism, which started off about one of the particular episodes and then eventually just, you know, it's basically always about communism.
Yeah, well, I suppose that was the prevailing issue of the day.
Exactly. So it's often about, you know, the badness of the state, in inverted commas. It's often about problems with conformity. It's often not very subtly about communism. It's often about attitudes to rule breaking, that the rule breakers are seen as being the good people often in the episodes.
Yes, but they are attacked or punished for it.
Yes.
But the message is that this is not a good thing.
Yeah.
But in terms of the moral message, I'm going to say something which is going to sound mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to preface it by saying that I thought overall the show was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I did enjoy all the episodes. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. But in terms of the voiceover and the moral message and the amount of information that is given in the episodes, it's incredibly heavy-handed.
Yes.
Incredibly heavy-handed.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, you know, I could see that this is the way that it was approached, perhaps in the writer's room, that they would come up with the moral message and then go, what story can we tell in 20 minutes? And the stories that were told are very small, and I don't think there's enough content to really fill even the 23-minute runtime.
Mm, interesting.
Especially in the second one, even though that was my favourite.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I guessed the twist right at the start.
Well, yes.
Yeah, it was. Mm-hmm. It's complicated because I had a lot of criticism for it, but it was very well done and very effective. And where was I going with this?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I also will ask very annoying questions because in a way that you normally do with my writing, which is quite quite useful. But in terms of short story writing, mm-hmm. you don't have to think about the practicalities. You don't have to think about happened before and what's going to happen afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
So the practical questions about how this came about or what particular characters are going to be able to do or have done is irrelevant. But still, hung up on a couple of things where I was like, but... And I realised that's completely not the point.
It's best not to pick at any of the stories.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because they're not...
Because they don't make sense.
They don't make any sense. They're not... The world building is not particularly great, but that's... I mean, listen to me. The world building is less important than the characters.
I know. We're taking the opposite roles because I'm going, but it doesn't make sense.
What's even happened?
Because of this. So that is quite interesting. But... In terms of they tell a very small, contained story, which makes a very strong point quite well.
Mm-hmm.
So well, in fact, that I don't think you really need your voiceover man at the end to say, and this is the lesson we have learned today, because it was fairly obvious.
I mean, maybe it wasn't fairly obvious in 1959.
Well, no. It was probably incredibly groundbreaking and quite shocking in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I'm saying it's very well done. But as a modern writer and consumer of media, I was sitting there going, oof, this is a bit much.
Mm.
But, yeah, it was very effective.
Before we get into individual episodes, can I briefly, very briefly, talk about cinematography and music?
Sure.
So the cinematography can be very different between the episodes. It's obviously, although they're written by essentially the same three people, they're directed by a fairly wide variety of folks.
Okay. Well, there we'd have to be.
And
with like 30 plus episodes a season, you'd need a rota.
Mm. So to make the point of the second one we're going to describe, it's shot in a lot of shadows and it's got some very weird angles, and there's...
Oh, the cinematography in that one was very clever.
And there's quite a few episodes that have again, things shot at weird angles and stuff, but there's also an awful lot of that are shot like the first and last ones, which are generally, you know, everyday small town USA long distance shots. You know, very normal. So it has a, the series has a variety of cinematography that's appropriate to the style of the thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
Because some episodes feel like they're everyday circumstances in which something odd has happened.
Mm.
And some feel, or some are set in completely
different worlds.
Different artificial worlds.
Yeah, so we had two that were very ordinary settings and one which was very fantastical setting.
Yeah. So sometimes, as you say, you get these quite fantastical settings. What we didn't get, by the way, in any of the ones that I chose, is some of them are very funny.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Can I give you the enormous spoiler?
Go for it.
In one of the episodes, one of the most famous episodes, the aliens land in their flying saucers on Earth, and they say, we are here to help people, and we will cure your diseases and stop your wars and everything. And humans say, you know, why would you do that? And they say, oh, it is in our book. Here is our book. And their book is all in an alien language. And then they take some people onto the spaceship to take back to their planet. And they start translating the book. And one of the people says, ah, I see that the reason why they've come to help us is their holy book, the cover, it says, to serve man. And you're like, ah, okay. And then later he goes in, it's a cookbook.
Okay. Right.
So.
Maha.
Sorry, where were we? I just want to sit here and tell you about all the other episodes that we have.
We don't have time for that. Oh. Sorry.
Yes, so I talked a bit about cinematography, but I briefly wanted to talk about music, which was interesting because the music is, as is so often the case, very strongly trying to steer the emotions of the people who are watching it. But it's done in an incredibly subtle and understated way, for the most part, that you don't often realise that it's even there. And in contrast, I feel, to the use of music in modern television, where it's often in your face.
Okay.
And I just wanted to say that I thought the music was very good and very subtle. So,
Fair enough.
What happens in the first episode?
So, the monsters are due on Maple Street. It is a weekend in a small town in America. Everybody is going about their business, washing their cars. Mowing the lawn, kids playing in the street. Then there is a light in the sky that flashes past and people go, oh, what was that? And they think it might be a meteor. And then the power goes out, the phones stop working, nobody can start their cars. And essentially what happens is they start, there's a kid there who says, oh, it's a bit like this story I read in a comic where the monsters come from outer space and weird things start happening. And it turns out that one of the families in the town has been monsters all along. And nobody knew. And very, very rapidly, the paranoia sets in and people start going, oh, his car started. He must be the monster. Or, you know, he stands outside in the middle of the night and looks up at the sky, so he must be the monster. Oh, we know that this guy works on a weird radio in his basement, so he must be the monster. Oh, the kid knew what was happening all along, so he must be the monster. And they start attacking each other. What I thought was particularly interesting was at one point when they've all started sitting outside into the night to watch various of the people to see what they do. And they've all started attacking each other verbally to begin with. Suddenly they start to hear footsteps approaching from the darkness, which seems as though it might be someone coming from the outside. Mm. And instantly they all band together again.
Oh, yeah.
Against the person who's coming from the outside, who then one of them shoots with a shotgun. And it turns out that it was the neighbour they sent round the corner earlier to see if the power was out in the next town. So it's all about massive paranoia. And
it's about communism.
It's about communism, yes. But it turns out, once they start actually throwing rocks through people's windows and actually physically attacking each other after the other neighbour's been shot and killed, that the aliens are in fact there and have invaded, but not in the way that you might expect, because they're just watching. And they say, what does it say? They pick the most dangerous enemy they can find, and it's themselves. We don't have to worry because the world is full of Maple Streets.
So what the aliens do, to make it clear, is they land on the top of the hill in their flying saucer.
And mess with the power.
And then they have a device that just switches the lights on and off and turns the cars on and off.
Yeah.
And that's basically all it does.
And all it need, that's all they need for the humans to start destroying themselves.
Yeah.
And each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a very subtle point. And obviously the way it escalates is ridiculously fast. But that is the point it's making in a very short space of time.
There are two things that I would pick to talk about in this episode. One of which is how often a character, several of the characters, points out what they are doing and the way that they are reacting is, air quotes, crazy. And yet they carry on doing it anyway.
Yes, absolutely. There are several times where actually one of the women and also the guy that I recognised from Garrison Gorillas attempt to call a halt to it and say, look, this is, yeah, this is crazy. We're acting irrationally, but it doesn't work.
We're crazy to be flustered about a power outage. This kid tells us a comic book plot and we all listen to him. Isn't that crazy?
One of the wives says, we've known their family for years. It doesn't seem right that we're watching them.
You're letting something start here. It's crazy. We shouldn't do that. But the reason, I think the main reason why it happens is as soon as somebody is accused, like the what I call the Henry Fonda-esque character, because he really reminded me of the character from 12 Angry Men.
Yes, me too.
Who up to now has been kind of like the leader and has been seen to be sensible and, you know, square-jawed and forthright and stuff, and someone turns around and says, you've been building a radio in your basement. And his response isn't, why don't you come and have a look?
Which is what his wife says. He immediately goes, no, they don't deserve to see in my basement. It's not, you know, it's not up to me to explain myself. And he immediately gets defensive and starts attacking them back.
And the guy who was looking up at the sky, who says that he has insomnia and sometimes he goes out and looks up at the sky but he can't sleep.
Mm.
They go up to his porch and instead of him having a chat, he immediately escalates.
Yeah, he says, if you take one more step onto my property, you'll be sorry, kind of a thing.
The reason why it goes like this is because when people are banding together to attack the other people, some of them are reluctant to say we should be doing this. But as soon as anybody is singled out, they don't try and show any kind of evidence or try and say, look, can't we be reasonable? They all become aggressive.
Yeah.
And my thought when I watched that originally was, isn't that very American?
Oh, well, maybe.
But I don't think that's necessarily the case because I think it's certain types of people.
Yes.
I would like to think that the kind of people that we hang out with wouldn't be like that, but I'm not sure that's true.
Mm.
And I don't think it's necessary. I thought it was an American stereotype, but I'm not convinced. I think it is just a thing that people will get defensive and aggressive when accused of stuff. I just tend to think that Americans do it more.
maybe. The one that got me was, as you were saying, you know, you would think that once Charlie, who's the one with the shotgun, actually kills the neighbour.
Mm.
And he says, I was only trying to protect my home. I didn't realise it was someone we knew.
Yeah.
You would think that that would shock everybody back into being sensible. Mm-hmm. But instead, they all turn on Charlie and one of them says, you were so quick to kill him. Maybe Pete was coming to tell us something about you.
Yeah.
And suddenly they're attacking him.
Yep.
And that's how it escalates every time.
Yep.
So yeah, it was very extreme.
Yep.
Very quickly, but it did make the point quite effectively.
Do you have anything else on the first one?
I don't think so, no.
No.
Shall we move on to Eye of the Beholder?
Yes, indeed.
Which, interestingly, was both my most and least favourite, because I thought it was very clever, and I thought it was very well done, particularly, as we said, the cinematography. But I did guess the twist almost immediately.
Yeah, but it's super and obvious.
It's very incredibly drawn out.
It's very,
with very little actually happening.
It's very obvious to us now.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, but it's still clever.
Yeah. I would really like to know how many people clocked the what to us now is extremely obvious twist when it first came out.
Yeah. So it is set in a hospital where there is a female patient with bandages all over her face, and it becomes known to us quite early on that she has what is considered some kind of deformity.
Mm-hmm. Facial deformity.
Facial deformity, yeah. Which the state says they need to attempt to correct it, and they've given 11 attempts at experimental treatments to fix the problem.
Yeah, so for reasons that aren't thoroughly explained, because it's a very short show, you can't have facial reconstructive surgery.
Yeah, because her bone structure doesn't support it.
Yeah. So what they've been doing is injecting her with stuff, which is supposed to fix it.
And this was her last chance, after which, if it doesn't work, she's going to be sent off to the village in the north to live with other people like her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very against this. And we get a television broadcast with the leader of the country or whatever community it is, the state.
The state.
Talking about how conformity is everything and everyone needs to be the same and that any differences must be stamped out.
Can I jump in briefly with the
thing? Of course.
So there's the episode I mentioned earlier with Burgess Meredith, in which is excellent, is called The Obsolete Man, I remember now. And the librarian is supposed to be obsolete, and through a clever twist of logic, by the end of the show, he demonstrates instead that the leader is the one who is obsolete, and then he is dragged off by his own people at the end.
Oh, wow. Okay. That sounds quite cool.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah.
So in this one, it became very obvious to me, because of the way it was shot, what the twist was going to be, because the patient has bandages all over her face, so we can't see her face. But every other character, who are the doctor and the nursing staff, for nearly all of the episode, are either shot in very heavy shadow or from behind, so you can't see their faces.
Mm-hmm.
So it became very obvious to me that it was going to be that they looked different to how we would expect people to look, and that the patient was going to look like a normal, in inverted commas, human.
Mm-hmm.
What I find really interesting about this is because when it is finally revealed, because they cut her bandages off and she is, to us, a very conventionally attractive person, and then you see the faces of the other people and they have pig snouts and very lopsided features that we would consider to be ugly, that not only have all of the actors, apart from the female protagonist who gets to, we get to see her face, and the guy who comes to take her to the mysterious village, who we also get to see his face,
who is also
very conventionally attractive by our standards.
Yep.
All of the other actors in the episode, you either don't see their faces or you see them with very heavy prosthetics.
Yep.
So you can't see any of them, which is really weird for actors in a TV show. I thought that was really interesting. So whilst it was incredibly obvious to me what it was going to happen, I thought it was very cleverly done, because they had to shoot it very carefully so that you didn't get the reveal too soon. And I thought that the way that the message was put across probably would have been quite shocking, and was still quite shocking to me when you actually see the makeup on the other actors. And I thought it made the point really well. Can I do my very annoying practicality pernickety thing?
Sure.
Because they said that if this last attempt didn't work, she would have to be shipped off
to go live on a farm.
Because she's not allowed to live amongst the normal-looking people, as it were. So where has she been living up till now? That's because she's like 30.
Yeah.
And she hasn't spent her entire life in the hospital with bandages over her face.
Who knows?
So where was she living? How was she making money?
Who knows?
Up until this point. So, yeah. But I appreciate that that is not the point, and that would ruin the message. But that was just something that kind of I tripped over, shall we say.
The other thing I was going to mention was the attitudes to the attitude of the hospital staff. The doctor says that pitiful, twisted lump of flesh that she calls her face. I wonder if in the 60s doctors would talk about people with a facial disfigurement in a way that says, these terrible people, we pitied them, and now the attitude would be much more, you know, this should just be something that we all treat as normal.
But interestingly also, one of the nurses says it's much easier to think of her as human when her face is covered. I have seen how terrible it is. And the doctor makes some kind of comment about how he's been trying to treat her for many years, and so he's got to know her quite well. And is it really so terrible to look different? Mm-hmm. And shouldn't we all think that we're all the same? And the nurse goes, oh, my dear doctor, that's treason. But you've just been under a lot of strain and you're very tired. But, you know, there is the hint that with, obviously, with close association, it becomes less frightening. It becomes less off-putting. And you get to see that people are all people.
When the toe screen, which is a phrase from 1984, when the toe screen is on and the leader is talking about glorious conformity,
we must
cut out all that is different and have the extermination of the undesirables. It's about communism.
Well, yes.
Because it's always about communism.
So do you think that the guy who admittedly everybody is in white because they're nursing staff or doctors and she's wearing a white patient gown, and the guy who comes to take her to the lovely village where she's going to become associated with people like her and live a nice life, he's all in black. Do you think he's actually a double agent of the government and she's actually going to be taken out of the back and shot?
That had never occurred to me.
Because all of the talk about glorious conformity and treason to think of them as people and we must cut out all the differences and exterminate it doesn't suggest to me that they would actually have a nice little village in the north somewhere where they're allowed to live perfectly nice lives.
See, I'd never thought of that. So possibly, I did briefly want to talk about him because she's had the bandages taken off and the thing hasn't worked and she still looks bad, in inverted commas. So she goes on the run very briefly and then runs into the room that he is in.
Yeah.
And he takes her by the arm and says, don't worry, you will be safe. Soon you will come to the village where you will learn to love it there. And then he looks at her and goes, and then says, and you will be loved. And I was just like, that is not as creepiest as all get out. It's just like, wow, okay.
Yeah, so now I'm thinking that maybe he's betrayed his people and he's actually there to put people onto a false sense of security and they're just, you know,
popped off.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's possible.
Thrown to the pigs, as it were.
Ew.
Have you got anything else on that one?
No. Should we do the more jolly last one?
Okay.
I did the last one as the last one.
The last one was really
sad. Well, maybe.
Oh, okay. It's called Kick the Can.
And I think it's the most famous one.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
It's set largely in an old people's home where none of the people seem to actually be that old, which is possibly partially the point.
I mean, it's relative.
Yeah, relative, obviously.
I mean, when you say not that old, they're in their 60s.
Yes. 60s, 70s. It's not that old.
Well, it isn't these days.
No, I suppose. Yeah, fair enough. And they're all kind of bumming around and not having a very nice life. And the protagonist, what's his name? Charlie. Is he another Charlie? Yes, he is. He's Charlie. Thinks that his son is going to come and get him. And it turns out his son was just coming for a visit to possibly talk about it and then leaves him there and drives away. And when he's on his way back, he sees a group of kids playing Kick the Can. And he picks up the can and has some reminiscences about having done that as a child.
Do you want to describe what this is, just so people understand?
I don't really know. There was one boy was kind of standing with his face to a tree counting while the others are all hiding. And then there was something about a can. I didn't really follow the rules of the game.
So I think he has to go off and tag people before they can get to Kick the Can.
Home base. Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah.
Ollie Ollie Oxenfree.
Yes.
Version. Yes. Got it. Okay. So he takes the can.
Did you play this when you were small?
I played Ollie Ollie Oxenfree. There was no can. Okay. We just had to touch the tree.
Okay. Yeah, me too when I was very small.
Yes. So he takes the can and he has these reminiscences and he comes to the conclusion that the only reason that he and all of the other people in the old people's home are unhappy is because they have set aside the attitudes of childhood and lost their ability to find joy and magic in the world.
They have put away childish things.
They have put away childish things. And that if he gets all of his fellow residents to go out in the middle of the night to play Kick the Can, they will somehow improve their lives. And what actually happens is that he manages to persuade all of them, apart from his childhood best friend, Ben, who says, "You're being ridiculous. You should act like other people and set aside these stupid ideas that you've got." And Ben stays inside and actually alerts the doctor to the fact that they've all gone outside. And when he goes outside to see what's happening, there's a bunch of children playing kick the can, and he realises that the one who's doing the counting and the seeking is actually Charlie, and they've transformed back into children, and he is left all alone, being old and miserable. And I thought it was really sad. And then I thought, but where are the kids going to live?
Yeah, don't go there.
Sorry.
They go into the trees where it is magic.
Uh-huh.
And everything is fine. Obviously, several things in this episode. I'll start off with a small one. I thought that it was interesting when the doctor said, you know, when I took this assignment, I didn't think I'd be doing it for the next, you know, 20 years. So he's obviously not chosen to go and do this. He's been told by somebody or decided to take the assignment to look after the old people, which doesn't sound great.
Yeah.
When Charlie starts misbehaving, because one of the things he does to try and pretend to be, not pretend to be, to try and act like a young person, he goes and plays in the sprinkler.
Yeah.
And then he is told that he's going to be taken away to the special ward for rule breaking.
Yeah.
And the...
he's going to be isolated
and the special,
until he calms down.
The special ward is where they put the people with dementia. They don't use the word, but that's effectively what it's implied. But they seem to say that if you are acting inappropriately, we automatically assume that you've got dementia and therefore, you know, sedate you and lock you up.
Yeah. But the thing that I wrote down was the obvious need for connection and support, because he says, "I can't play kick the can alone. You've all got to come with me."
So I thought what was really interesting about that is we've talked in both of the episodes so far about conformity. There's the, when in the first episode, somebody gets pointed at and they go, "Oh, it must be him who's the monster because of X reason." And everybody immediately falls into line and says, "Yes, yes, it's him." Partly to, you know, not be accused themselves, but also because there's safety in conformity. Yeah. And in the second one, obviously the leader is like, "We must conform." And in this one, when he says, "I'm going to go out and play kick the can, who's with me?" As soon as like one or two other people say, "I'll come and join you," everybody falls into line behind him, apart from
his
friend.
And there's also the point that he doesn't want to be alone.
Yes.
The rule breaker, because then he stands out and gets persecuted. Whereas if he's got people with him, you know, you can't, with you know, just one doctor and a couple of nurses, you can't control and punish the entire set of residents. There's safety in numbers still, but in the opposite direction. The
opposite direction,
which is really interesting.
So what do you think, we could do like a whole podcast on this, but what do you think is, I'm trying to think how to put this, what do you think needs to be reintroduced to these people in order for them to be better, in inverted commas?
See, this is what Stanley the Bear's book, Meditations on Being Amazing, available now, is all about. Because in the introduction, I say that most of the time, stuffed animals are seen as restricted to childhood, and it's quite odd for an adult to have a teddy bear that they engage with in the same way, and that it seems a shame because teddy bears can be extremely supportive and you don't feel silly telling them things, your secrets, they don't judge you, you know, it's a safe companion to have to reflect back to you that you are enough and that, you know, that there are good things in life. And that everybody, there shouldn't be a stigma about it, which is why I'm sitting in this room surrounded by stuffed animals and have written a book, or helped Stanley write a book in his voice about how to make a better relationship with yourself. So I think, generally speaking, the two of us and the other members of my family in particular are very good at maintaining childish attitudes in the pursuit of joy.
Very good. Yep. Diversity?
Sure. I did think that it was a bit odd that all three were about breaking conformity or not persecuting people who are different, but there was zero diversity in any of them at all.
So the middle one has a female main protagonist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were good female characters in all of them.
Several of the episodes, several of the really memorable episodes, including two that I can think of immediately, which I really want to talk about, would absolutely freak you out, have female protagonists.
Yeah.
So there's...
And as I said, in the first one, it was the women generally who were trying to be the voice of reason and get people to calm down.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I tell you about one of them?
No. So yes, there was some... Stop it. There were some decent female characters, and as you say, the protagonist in the second one was a woman.
Yeah, that's, I say, I think that's probably about a third of them have a
but they were protagonist. All three were 100% white.
Yeah, it's interesting because I definitely remember this black characters in the shelter.
Okay.
And George Takei is playing obviously a I think he plays a Japanese gardener to essentially a guy who had in the Second World War been in the Japanese invasion and has some kind of weird PTSD where he thinks that he's back fighting the Japanese again.
Mm.
And then, you know, has a whole thing with George Takei.
You could also say that to a certain extent all of them are about mental attitudes and to a varying degree mental health and finding a better attitude and a better... way of thinking about yourself and others.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the...
Dealing with trauma, disability...
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the episodes are
age.
Specifically touch on mental health.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of them, I'd say, you know, again, like maybe a third touch on some mental health aspects in some ways or other. But, yeah, no robots in this one, though.
No robots, no. I mean, I'm sure in the 156 episodes there must have been some
probably,
robots.
Probably, but I don't really remember.
It's not really a robot kind of a show, even with
the
speculative aspects, but
yeah.
I'm sure there were some.
There's a lot more magical, realist type of stuff in the show than there is ever any much in the way of science fiction.
Yeah.
So, does that wrap it up for this month's discussion?
I think so.
In which case, it must be time for the ratings.
Yeah.
What did you think of the original 1950s-60s version of The Twilight Zone?
Well, using our standard five-star rating system with half stars allowed, I'm going to give it 3.5.
Okay.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was very well done in some aspects. But other aspects were a bit clunky and a bit heavy-handed. And that I'm not sure the stories in and of themselves had enough content to really fill the running time over and above the message that they were trying to make. But the message was very clear and very effective and in a lot of ways well done. How about you?
So I'm going to kind of cheat.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to give it a score based on all of it that I've seen and not just the 3 episodes that we watched.
Okay.
So I think I'm going to give it 4.5.
Wow. So that's from you only highlighting 30 out of 156 episodes that you actually thought were really good.
Well, no, those are just my favourite ones that I thought I might rewatch.
Oh, okay.
I mean, in terms of the ones that I think are, air quotes, good, probably about 90% of them.
Oh, wow.
I mean,
okay.
There's obviously a bunch of clunkers. But, you know, in 156 episodes, you're going to have a bunch that are bad.
Of course.
But I'd say 80, 90% of them are fine. And then there's, you know, 30-odd that really, really stood out as being really good enough to want to keep.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I think about 4.5 for me.
Wow. So biggest question of all, did you still love it?
Oh, it's amazing.
Good.
Right. Dare I even ask, next time on...
Next time on Will You Still Love It Tomorrow, I am picking the 1998 US college drama Felicity for a very specific reason, which I'll be interested to know if you can figure out.
Right. Well, I shall look forward to it. How many episodes?
We'll probably do two. Like
okay.
First two.
Cool. Well, let me know and I will find some time.
Okay. That's it for this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks, as ever, to Cambo for our theme music. And thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments or you want to tell us about a time when you shared some media you love, whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can always email us at willyoustillloveit@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.
And do join us next time to find out what Dave thinks of Felicity.
And whether or not Annie still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.